Hi, and thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, David Gottlieb. Throughout the centuries of emancipation and assimilation of the Jewish communities of Europe, and even during the years of their persecution and annihilation, one institution provided refuge, sustenance, and material for Jewish artistic, cultural, political, and literary expression, and that institution was the cafe. In his latest book, A Rich Brew, How Cafes Created Modern Jewish Culture, published by New York University Press in 2018, Shachar M. Pinsker delves into the history of the cafe in six different Jewish communities in Europe, the U.S., and Palestine and later Israel, from the early 19th into the late 20th century. The author shows how the cafe was both a liminal and a creative space. It was a locus of cultural and artistic foment, of political and intellectual conflict and collaboration, and a third space in which cultural, linguistic, and gender boundaries were blurred or altogether remade. Shachar Pinsker is professor of Judaic Studies and Middle East Studies at the University of Michigan, and he joins me today to discuss his book. Professor Pinsker, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and speak with you.
I wonder if you could give us some context by just telling us a little bit about your personal and academic background, about your scholarly expertise and your perspective and how those things led you to this book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm from Israel, and I studied at the Hebrew University for my BA and MA. I actually studied comparative literature and focused on Hebrew literature. I also have a little bit of yeshiva background, and this is kind of the way that led me to work on the literature and the cultural aspects and the questions that I came later to work on. Then I decided to leave the Hebrew University after being there for many years and go to Berkeley, California, and to do a PhD with the wonderful people that were there, people like Professor Robert Alter, Hannah Kronfeld, and Omi Zeidman. And that really kind of opened my eyes, being in an American environment, being in a place like Berkeley, and really think about Hebrew literature in the culture of Jewish literature, Jewish history, Jewish culture, and also in the larger context of comparative literature, world literature, and many of the cultural debates and theoretical and political issues that that were very prevalent in during the time I did my PhD in Berkeley. It was really a wonderful place that to be, and an experience that really opened my eyes to many things. Then I spent a year at Harvard. I spent a year back in Israel at Ben Gurion University, and then I came to Michigan, and the Frankel Center and the University of Michigan again opened new horizons and new places for me. Writing such a book like A Rich Brew is not really, doesn't seem like a natural thing to do for somebody who is trained as a literary scholar.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because your previous book is Literary Passports, The Making of Modernist Hebrew Fiction in Europe. And I'm wondering if, as you were researching that book, you kept coming across the cafe as an institution where modern Hebrew fiction was being created. Was that part of what led you
precisely
to the material?
That's exactly
the rich
what happened
material for this book.
I wanted to write a book about Hebrew modernism and really to focus on the texts themselves, the writers and the text, and to do the kind of analysis, the close reading that goes along with that. And you know, as I was doing research for the book and then I was writing the book, I decided in the previous book Literary Passport to focus on three themes or three big areas, and one of them is the religious experience, one of them is gender and sexuality, and the third one is the urban environment. event. So what I wanted to do there was to see where people, what were the cities that people immigrated to and worked in, and how they represented the this urban experience in their writing, which was all new and it was all in the context of modernism. And then I started asking questions in that book and the work that I did around it, something that is kind of in between traditional, or what you would call literary scholarship and cultural history. And yeah, that's exactly what happened. I really tried to know the cities very well and to ask kind of questions. Okay, so where actually people, we know that people move to Odessa and Warsaw and Berlin and other places. And we know that they were influenced by German literature and Yiddish literature, and we can do analysis of the text and see all these contacts, but where actually did it happen? Did they actually meet each other? Did they talk to each other? Was there any, and the answer I kept coming to was the cafe, was the coffee house.
Really, really interesting. And what kind of a space was it? When did the coffee house itself emerge in Europe? And what were these spaces physically like?
Yeah, so this is a very good question. It's also a difficult question to answer because there are so many different variations on what these places and what these spaces were. I mean, we know that the origin of coffee and of coffee houses, I mean, it came through Africa and then really emerged in places like Mecca and in the Arab world in the medieval period, in the Islamic context, and later on with the Ottoman Empire. This is where the institution of the coffee house thrived and really became a place not just for people to drink the new coffee, the new exotic drink that was that woke people up and enabled people to stay awake at night and all, you know, new things like that, but also it was a place for religious activity, for Sufis, for intellectual activity, for cultural activity, for sociability, and that all happened in the Islamic context, and from the Islamic world via the Ottoman Empire, and partly by Sephardic Jews, but also by Armenians and other people who were part of the world of commerce and merchants, they brought it over to Europe, to Western Europe. And actually the first coffee houses were in England, in London and in Oxford. And we're not 100% sure, but we know for sure that one of the first ones were established in Oxford, a place known as the Angel, and that it was by a Sephardic Jew, probably from Lebanon. We only know his first name, Jacob. These places emerged in England. Actually, if you look at some photographs, it's very interesting because it was obviously very different from the ones that you would see in the Ottoman Empire. It kind of looked a little more like a pub, like a place where people would drink beer, right? And would be kind of like a tavern without wine or without beer. Instead of it was coffee. Uh-huh. At the same time, it kept these otherness because there were some elements that were Oriental or Muslim elements that were then that were part of the way the coffee house looked in England, and then later on in Italy and in Vienna and in the German speaking countries. So there was always something that was very local, but also it was something that kind of reminded people of the otherness, of the fact that coffee itself and the institution of the coffee house came from elsewhere. It took many years, I think, from what I can gather from the description of the places and from some of the visual, the photographs and the artwork. It took a while to really develop, let's say, the Viennese cafe as a Viennese institution. Early on, it was very clear that it's it's coming from elsewhere, and it had this kind of very interesting oriental slash other element to it.
And maybe it's that orientalness and otherness that caused many of the critics in some of these cities that you describe to regard the coffee house as kind of an alien institution where the Jew, a resident alien, as it were, felt at home. What was it about the cafe that drew Jews to it?
Yeah, so you know, I mean, the otherness of the cafe is definitely part of it. I mean, if you think about beer and tavern, and if you think about wine house or liqueurs, it's all done in the soil of the place, right? It's very much connected to the place, and you can say that the institution where these drinks are being drunk, it's very much connected to the place. It's also the difference between alcohol and coffee that explains some of that. So, I mean, the answer of why Jews were attracted to it and why it became identified as Jewish, you know, in some sense, although almost never exclusively as Jewish, it has to do with all of these different elements. You know, the fact that there was an air of otherness about it. It was very much became localized, but also came from elsewhere, kind of like Jewish culture, you know? And from the Jewish point of view, I mean, in the early days, you look at the 16th, 17th, early 18th centuries, I mean, most Jews, if not everybody, were keeping kosher. So eating in a restaurant or going to a pub with Jews, that would be out of the question. And also many people did not feel comfortable in the context of alcohol, and the coffee house was a great alternative. In most of the coffee houses earlier on, there was only coffee served. It's only later that it became with pastries and food and all that. So it enabled many Jews who kept kosher and did not want to eat along with non-Jews to go to the coffee house. So there was another element that made it attractive or kind of more of a neutral place for Jews to come as alternative to other either more exclusive places or places where the issue of kashrut was problematic, or even the issue of alcohol. That, you know, that doesn't mean the Jews didn't drink or didn't like alcohol. They did, right? Right? And many Jews also own taverns, especially in Eastern Europe, but that doesn't mean that they felt comfortable sitting there and socializing and meeting other people, both Jews and non-Jews. And the coffee house was exactly that kind of place that enabled people to feel more comfortable.
And perhaps this is why perhaps this is what makes the coffee house what you describe as a third space. I think this is a crucial concept in your book. Can you explain this term and the role the concept of the third space plays in understanding and depicting Jewish cafe life?
Yeah, so it's really I really came to this concept, which was developed in the context of cultural geography, out of a problem. You know, I mean, I knew that most of the places, most of the coffee houses I write about, they don't exist anymore. In a place like Cafe Central, which still exists, resembles more a museum than a living institution. People go there with cameras and take pictures. There's a life-size sculpture of Peter Altenberg, one of the habitués. And really what we have of these places are descriptions, subjective description, literary descriptions, even photographs are very subjective. So we don't have access to the actual space and to the lived experience. And in the beginning, I thought, you know, that's a big problem, because how can I rely on this information? And then as the more I did reading, and the more I understood that actually the place itself is so important, but really what is going on there is the experience of the space, and the experience of the space is subjective. So it's something that is between the imaginary and the real. It's between the public and the private. So really the third space as something that comes from cultural geography is really a good way to capture some of these contradictions and the liminality of the space, you know, of something that is inside, between the inside and the outside, between the public and the private, between the real and the imaginary, and kind of our desire to fix on what really was there is almost besides the point, because what's really important is how people experienced it, and that explains how the same space can be experienced in such a different way for different people,
and also in different places. You consider six cities in the book in considerable detail: Odessa, Warsaw, Vienna, Berlin, New York, and Tel Aviv. And Jewish cafe culture, as you point out, was vibrant in other cities as well. But you had to restrict your focus somewhere, and these cities make a lot of sense. But tell us what makes them the most important and what is common between them in terms of Jewish cafe life.
Yeah, so really, I mean, the book could be expanded and could be continued. And actually, I hope, I know that some people are working, some people already published, and some people are working on coffee houses in Paris, in Cairo, in Baghdad, in Buenos Aires, in many other places. For me, it made sense to focus on these six cities because they really represent modern Jewish culture in Eastern Europe, with Odessa and Warsaw as two large cities. One of them was part of the Russian Empire, of the Pale of Settlement, and then later on with Soviet Jewry. Warsaw, the capital of Poland, which was at some point in the beginning of the 20th century the largest city in Europe. The largest Jewish city in terms of population in Europe, right. and the most important. And then with Vienna and Berlin, obviously two capital cities of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then of the German Empire, and later on the Weimar Republic. But all these places, and then, you know, as you move from Europe to America, obviously New York City was the place of Jewish population and Jewish immigration, and in Palestine, and then later the State of Israel, Tel Aviv. There was always competition between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem finds a way into the book, but Tel Aviv was really the cultural center.
Right.
And these cities are really important. They're important by themselves, and of course the interaction between Jewish culture and German culture and Austrian culture, Russian, Polish, American, and in Israel the local Arab and British culture. But there were also centers of migration. That's one of the important and crucial points.
Yes,
that
correct.
Migration and urbanization are really connected to each other very intimately and are very central in understanding Jewish modernity. And I think that, I mean, I'm not the first one, obviously, to point that out. I mean, many Jewish historians and literary scholars and other people who work on Jewish modernity pointed out that element of the urban experience. But I think we kind of tend to normally look at it from the point of view of immigration as kind of one direction. You know, people start somewhere in some small shtetl or some city in Europe, and, you know, they move to New York, or they move to Tel Aviv, or they move to Berlin, and kind of that's it. And then we look at it. But the coffee houses also, it took me a while to understand it, enabled me to show something that I call kind of a silk road of modern Jewish culture, because it's really a network of migration, and the coffee houses are points in this network and this silk road, because people don't just immigrate, and that's it. People constantly move. It was very typical for many of the writers and the people I write about, the intellectuals, the politicians, the journalists, the artists, to move many, many times during their lifetime. And even those who only moved once, they traveled, they corresponded, they read each other. So, and very
and
often
they looked for each other in the cafes, didn't they?
Exactly. And they looked at each other in the cafe. I mean, there's so many times. I mean, I begin the book with Agnon, but it happens again and again that people travel from one city to another, either by train or by sea or anyway, and they would get off the train or off the ship, and the first place that they will go will be the coffee house. That's quite amazing. Yeah. I mean, why? Yeah. You know, why would that be the case? I mean, after all, there are more important places than right. the coffee house, but it shows you that people... First of all, people knew about it before they even went to visit the city. They read about, they heard about these places. They knew that by going to the coffee house, it's going to connect them immediately to the people, to the culture, to the intellectual debates. The coffee house will really enable them to get the pulse of the culture and the city yes. very immediately.
You know, one of the interesting themes that emerges in the book and in almost all of the cities that you researched, if not in all of them, is the theme of self-alienation and even emasculation of the modern emancipated Jewish artist, at this time virtually all of whom are male. And this characteristic of alienation and sort of ennui and emasculation, these things seemed to both be assuaged and exacerbated by the marginality of the cafe. In other words, people went to the cafe seeking refuge from this feeling, but in some ways the cafe manifested or fertilized this feeling. Can you right. explain a little bit about why that was the case and what larger forces were contributing to it?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, until now, we really focused on the cafe, on the coffee house as a place that enables connections and open up possibilities for migrants and for people who move from one place to another. But at the same time, it really emphasized all the tensions around, you know, the challenges of modernity in the Jewish context. So that has to do sometimes with relationship between Jews and non-Jews and anti-Semitism, uh-huh. right? I mean, the fact that, you know, if in Vienna people would know that the Jew belongs in the coffee house, right? That means that it puts them, I mean, it's such a, if you analyze it, you know, what does it mean?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It could mean two conflicting things. You know, it could mean that really this is where, you know, look how the Jews are now part of intellectual community, and, you know, so many Jews are so prominent in the arts, in literature, in journalism, and, you know, the Viennese coffee house is a beloved institution at that point, and the Jew belongs there, so the Jew really belongs in Vienna. On the other hand, it can be exactly the opposite. You
yes.
know, the Jew belongs in the coffee house and nowhere else.
Yes.
You know,
right.
it's kind of
right.
like being in the zoo, and we can see that a lot in many places. You know, in Warsaw, for example, there's a place called the Cafe Zimianska, and there actually the Jews like Jewish writers like Slonimski and Tuvim, who wrote Polish and very much wanted to be part of Polish culture, they went to the cafe, and they had this kind of elevated space that was known as the table, the regular table, and, you know, that attracted a lot of attention, and many people came to them and looked up to them, but that also put them on the spot for people who hated the fact that they were so prominent in Polish culture. So all these tensions around Judaism and anti-Semitism, around gender, around class, around issues of, you know, the Jewish man. And you said, yeah, most of the people were men. There were very few women that I write about in the book who were part of modern Jewish culture, and they experienced it in a very different way, because it was mostly kind of experienced as a homosocial space, right? As really as a modern substitute to the synagogue or to the house of study, where traditionally Jewish men would argue with, would study the Talmud and argue with each other. And, you know, instead of that, it became very clear for a lot of the participants that the coffee house is really a secular modern substitute of the house of study. And obviously, if you're a woman like Leah Goldberg or Anna Margolin or Alza Lasker Schiller, you know, what is their place in the cafe? Because after all, unlike the house of study, the Beit Midrash, coffee house, that's the whole idea. Yeah. It's open to everybody. Women could go in there and did go in there. The question of how many women were really habitués and part of the inside of cafe culture, very few women.
Right. And you talk about, you give vivid examples throughout the book of the habitués and the circles of prominent literary, cultural, and political figures, including in the Viennese cafe, many of which are frequented by luminaries like Sigmund Freud and Theodor Herzl. But you also talk, and Herzl is kind of a bridge to this, about some of the literary forms that are thought of as particularly Jewish and which find their home and a lot of their material in the cafe, including the feuilleton, which Herzl specialized in, and the Moralische Wochenschriften, which was sort of a series of, as I understand it, weekly pamphlets to get assimilating Jews to elevate their moral and social niceties so that they fit into culture better. Can you talk about why some of these forms found such fertile soil in the cafe and who were some of their primary expositors?
Yes. So, I mean, part of the, when we spoke before about the coffee house entering Western Europe in London and Oxford and then in Vienna and other places, it really went hand in hand with the development of journalism and newspapers. And, this is the thesis of Habermas about the public sphere. And, you know, something like the Moralische Wochenschrift, it was these kind of newspapers that started, they really started together with the institution of the coffee house. I mean, many of the debates and the discussions of the coffee house were kind of reproduced in a printed form.
Which is interesting because at this time you're starting to see mass circulation daily newspapers.
Right. So this is
So the coffee house becomes a space for that consumption of that information.
Exactly. So both the discussions of the coffee house find its way into a written representation, but then also the coffee house is the place where people come to read newspapers. And this is something that goes back to the early days and continues even until today, where, you know, many coffee houses have all kind of newspapers in many different languages, and that's part of the appeal. But then, you know, when you talk about the feuilleton, which really started in Paris at the beginning of the 19th century, it was a very urban genre. Really started with kind of what's going on around town, right? I mean,
Oh, so a great example is like the talk of the town in the New Yorker. That's
how it started. But then it really developed in all kind of ways, and it enabled people to have a cultural criticism and a mixture of something that is very personal and has a narrative element to it, together with what is going on in the city, what are some of the events, what are some of the... So it always has this kind of current and urban element mixed with a storytelling element and also cultural criticism, something about the politics of the day, etc. And
Why did this come to be seen as such a Jewish
form? That's one of the really interesting questions, and that's actually I'm now involved together with other people in a new project that is going to be a collaborative project, specifically about the feuilleton and the Jewishness of the genre. I mean, obviously, there's nothing Jewish about it. It started in Paris, and very very quickly it moved into German cities and to Russian cities, and really all over the world. It actually didn't catch up so much in the English-speaking world. And you know, one of the first people who brought it from the French to the German is Heinrich Heine. So that's one reason why. But then, you know, later on, it really became, for all kind of interesting reasons, it became something that attracted many Jews, like Herzl, like Josef Roth, like, so in Austrian and German sphere, it really became known as kind of a Jewish genre, even if people, obviously not everybody who wrote there was Jewish, you know. Why so many Jews came to write feuilletons? That's an interesting question. It has some historical reasons, it has some literary reasons, but, you know, when what I found really fascinating is that from anti-Semitic point of view, when people in Germany and looking at German culture and Austrian culture looked at the fact that so many Jews are writing feuilletons, and that it's kind of a style, it's something that mixes different genres, right? So it's not pure. But from that point of view, it's like, okay, Jews are writing it because they can't really write literature, real literature, in German or in, you know, they're Jews, they can't really do it, they don't know the language enough, they're not really part of the, so they took this foreign French genre and brought it over to you know, to the German speaking sphere, right? So that's in the context of German, and I think also you have something similar going on in Poland and in Russia. But then also, you know, if you think about the 19th century, the development of Hebrew and Yiddish press, the feuilleton was very popular. People loved to read it. It also was something that was kind of light and, you know, mixed all the cultural and political events of the day, but in a way that was accessible, that involved
and entertaining.
So, you know, if you think about the Haskalah and how, you know, the Maskilim had to deal with Hebrew, with a very difficult language, with biblical language, and, you know, in Yiddish, it's a language that kind of lacked legitimacy. The feuilleton really emerged as something that is wonderful for writers to experiment with, for publishers and editors to sell more newspapers, and for readers to really read with pleasure, as opposed to read the, you know, the kind of the polemical and ideological articles of the Maskilim. So it's very interesting to see how it emerged in the 19th century and beginning 20th century in many different languages, both Jewish languages and non-Jewish languages, for a variety of reasons. And although it was never kind of like the coffee house, it was never exclusively Jewish, it was something that was beloved and utilized by many Jews, and also became identified to some extent with Jewishness and with Jewish culture.
And, you know, the cafe was really kind of a battleground of Jewish culture in all these places. Just to pull two examples, you mentioned in your chapter on Berlin that cafe habitués fought against what their parents aspired to: upward mobility, social status, and the prosperity that opened to them with emancipation. So they fought not just against decadent Europe, but against the perceived superficiality of Jewish observance. That's one kind of struggle. And in Jaffa and Tel Aviv, we have a battle over what is to be the language of Jewish culture. Is it going to be Yiddish, or is it going to be Hebrew? So in both of these places, and in all the others you discuss, the cafe is kind of a battleground, either cultural or political. But in the cultural context, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how Jaffa and Tel Aviv, how the battles that played out there in terms of what was to be the language of Jewish culture.
Yeah, so I mean, when it comes to Jaffa, Tel Aviv, it's really interesting. First of all, from a historical point of view, we spoke about how coffee houses started in the Middle East and then went to Europe. when Jewish immigrants are immigrating from Europe to Jaffa at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, in a sense, they go back to the place where coffee houses started, right? But then they go to the Arab cafes in Jaffa and they don't like what they see. These places look to them very dirty, and you know, people play sheshbesh and smoke nargilas. It looks nothing like the Viennese or the coffee house or the one in Warsaw in Lhasa, and they want to bring their own. So they want to create European cafes in Tel Aviv, right? And sometimes they are aware and sometimes they are not aware that actually this whole institution came from the Middle East. You know, Agnon writes about Beta Kahava. He keeps the Kahawa, the Arabic word there. And I think he did it on purpose in order to kind of show the irony of people like him who came from Europe and, you know, kind of, you know, finding the coffee house kind of in between. So, you know, Arabic was part of the battle of languages. Yiddish, right? I mean, most of the immigrants who came, Yiddish was their mother tongue. Many of the immigrants came with German. And at the time, you know, the attempt to create Hebrew as a living language, that was a difficult battle, right? I mean, and many people felt very insecure. You know, they wanted to create this monolingual culture, and they felt that in order to create create a Jewish culture in a city like Tel Aviv, you really need to get everybody to speak Hebrew, and everything has to be around Hebrew. But the coffee house was really a multilingual space everywhere.
Yeah, I wonder if you could read us one of the poems or writings that emerged out of the Hebrew speaking world and the cafes of Jaffa and Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you know, there are so many great texts by people like Avraham Shlonsky and Nathan Alterman and Leah Goldberg. These are Hebrew writers who also wrote in other languages. There are many Yiddish writers who wrote texts, you know, not just spent time in the cafe and met there, but also wrote poetry or prose about the coffee house. I wanna read actually one of the later texts. You know, I mean, in terms of the time framework, of course, when we talk about the European coffee house, by the time of Second World War, you know, the coffee houses that were part of Jewish culture were gone in the war,
right?
But they continued in many ways to the 60s and 70s in New York City and in Tel Aviv. And one of the most well-known coffee houses in Tel Aviv was Cafe Kassit. That was the owner was Hatzkal, an East European Jew, was a Yiddish speaker, and you know, it attracted many people, mostly immigrants who spoke Yiddish and also Hebrew. But then later on, it continued in the 40s and 50s and 60s and all the way to the 80s as a very important place in Israeli culture after the establishment of the State of Israel. And, you know, if we look at one poem, this is Avot Yeshurun poem. His real name is Yechiel Perlmutter, and he changed his name, he Hebraized his name to Avot Yeshurun. And Avot is a very unusual name that has to do with the fathers. And you know, he came from a Yiddish speaking house in Poland. He put into his poetry Yiddish and Polish and Arabic, all within his very unique Hebrew Hebrew poetry, and he was one of the cafe habitués. He went to Cafe Kassit, although he was always a marginal figure in Cafe Kassit, unlike people like Alterman, who were at the center. And he wrote this poem in 1972 about a coffee house. He doesn't say which one it is, but it could be Cafe Kassit or one of the other cafes. Why don't, is it okay if I read it in Hebrew and then with the English translation? Okay. So, בבית קפה מצד הרחוב, מי שהיו פה אינם, מי שחשוב כמת ומי שחשוב כנם. רק סדרן זקן מן הקולנוע, עם לבן זקן מן הבימה, והדובה הגדולה על הגג מציצה אליה פנימה. משחקים שח, הבית, קפה, מלא דצמבר, שומעים ג'ון באז, שרה, I remember. So this is an attempt of English translation. It's very difficult to translate Avot Yeshurun. In a cafe, by the side of the street, those who were here are gone. He whose number is dead, and he whose number is slumber. Only an old usher from the cinema, with a white old from Habima, and the great bear on the roof glancing at it inside. Playing chess, the coffee house is full December, listening to John Baez singing, I remember. So, you know, I mean, it is a beautiful poem, and it's a very difficult poem to understand. I think when we read it, we kind of get the sense of the atmosphere and what is going on in the cafe. But, you know, to understand all the little details and all the different elements, you know, a lot of it has to do with the time, with places like Habima and the cinema and these old characters, those people in the 60s and
70s. Right. But very much like the cafe, it's a third space that sort of contains the ghosts of people
right,
who are
right,
no longer
exactly. And that is a lot about, you know, those who are gone and those who died. And obviously this is after the Holocaust, this is after the 1948 war, and you have all these people who are present in the memory of the people, and, you know, maybe they used to spend some time in the cafe, or maybe their family members, and you know, at the end of the poem, when it's playing chess, and the coffee, I tried in my English translation to kind of break it the way it breaks it. In Hebrew, it's instead of Beit Cafe, right? It's two words, Beit Cafe, the coffee house, he breaks it. And here, it's very clear that it's not just the coffee house, it's a bayit, it's the house. And, you know, everything with all the meaning of that, right? And then, you know, sending us away from Tel Aviv and away from Cafe Kassit to John Baez in America, you know, singing I Remember. And then if you look at the song, it is about the Holocaust, and about memory, and about what can be remembered and what cannot be remembered, and how by singing about it and writing poems about it, it's the problem of memory and how to try and bring back to life something that doesn't exist anymore. And I love this poem because it's, you know, so typical of Avot Yeshurun and his specific thematics, but it's also something that really kind of at the end, towards the end of my book, because it's also kind of the end of an era of very vibrant cafe culture and coffee houses. And, you know, this is something that I talk about a little bit in the afterword, in the conclusion of the book.
So the Jewish cafe is gone. And I wonder if you can address what has taken its place, if anything, and will anything like it ever return to its old form? In other words, what carries Jewish culture now?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I actually wanted to finish the book with an open question. You know, I don't feel like I have the answer, and there is a big question here, because obviously it's absurd to say that you know, coffee houses don't exist anymore. It's actually the opposite. Yeah. There are more coffee
right.
houses today in all
There's
the cities.
There's one in Tel Aviv every 10 feet.
Right, exactly. And in all the different cities that I write about, there's probably today more coffee houses than they were in the period that I'm writing about. And yet, that kind of activity and the importance of coffee house for modern Jewish culture, it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, there are maybe a few places where this kind of cultural activity takes place, but a very few places. And I don't think anyone would argue that the coffee house is such an important element in contemporary Jewish culture. And the question is why, you know? I really invite readers to give their own answers to these questions. But I think it's a combination of a few things. First of all, the nature of the coffee house changed very much. Mm-hmm. And the function and the role that it fulfilled has been replaced by other things, you know, the social media and the internet. There are many, many ways for people in various places to interact with each other that doesn't require the space of the cafe, you know. And if you think about the early days of the internet, I don't know how many people remember, but there used to be a lot of cafes in the, you know, many of the spaces in the internet where people would meet each other and discuss and have questions. It used to be called cafe. Maybe it's not anymore with Twitter and Facebook and other.
Right.
But I think a lot of what was going on in the cafe was replaced, and the fact that there's so much technology. I mean, even people like myself, I still love going to cafes but I come, sometimes I meet people, but most of the time I come with my own laptop and I'm kind of absorbed within that. So it's a very different kind of function.
Everyone is in their own cafe.
Right. So that's part of it. I think the other part is that the immigration that was so crucial. It's not that there's no Jewish immigration now. I mean, obviously there's the former Soviet Union people who moved to America and to Israel and to Central Europe, but contemporary Jewish culture nowadays is not. Immigration is not as crucial element. And, you know, I mean, we also have to be careful kind of not to romanticize, because we spoke about the difficult elements in the coffee house and how for many people the coffee house was the only place where they could go because they didn't have other places. You know, in that sense, exactly. Maybe it's good today that we have many other possibilities for creating a Jewish culture. So, you know, there's something that... I think there's something that, like many other things, something is lost with the fact that this world is gone, and something that we should actually be happy about that it's. I don't want to be kind of too nostalgic about it, you know. I speak about the issue of nostalgia and how, you know, how you can look at it in many different ways, and hey, it's also, who knows? Maybe this is going to come back, you know. I mean, maybe you never know.
You never know, but you certainly have made the coffee house vividly present in this book, which is both beautifully written and very, very well researched. I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us about it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for doing this interview and asking many great questions. I enjoyed the conversation very much.
The feeling is mutual. My guest today has been Shachar M. Pinsker, professor of Judaic Studies and Middle East Studies at the University of Michigan. And we've been talking about his new book, A Rich Brew, How Cafes Created Modern Jewish Culture, published in 2018 by New York University Press. Again, this is David Gottlieb. Thank you for joining me on New Books in Jewish Studies.